In this part of the program, we'll be looking for your healthcare questions. This is a program that we do every other month. We call it our Talk to the Family Doctor Show because the guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic. In his practice, he sees a wide range of folks with a wide range of issues. He sees adults and kids. And the idea is these many years ago, asked if he'd come by on a fairly regular basis for a wide open kind of program. So anything that's on your mind, any healthcare issue, could be for you, could be for your kids. If you have concerns or questions, you are welcome to call. And I know he will do his best to help you out. We know that, as we always say at the beginning of these programs, we can't diagnose over the phone. There are limits to what we can do on the show, but we do these programs to try to add to your store of knowledge. And then, of course, if you have concerns, you should pursue them with your own physicians. But anybody's welcome to call, and I know that Dr. Jeff will do his very best to give you an answer. 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Thank you, David.
Glad to have you here. Well, nature seems to have gotten pretty serious about it being winter.
I was glad that my car and myself both started this morning.
Indeed. Well, and we're glad you made it over here. Just for grins, we could talk a little bit about frostbite.
Yeah.
Because we have had very serious cold, and we have those sub-zero wind chills, and we know that exposed flesh I've even heard people read these warnings, exposed flesh can freeze in a matter of minutes.
That is correct.
So maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea to talk a little bit about what are the symptoms of frostbite, and then if you really think that you have had some frostbite or someone in your family has, what do you do?
Okay. Well, one of the key things that people need to remember is that the cells that make up the body are approximately 80% water. So if you left a container of water outside, whatever would happen to it at that temperature is eventually what would happen to you if there isn't some sort of insulation between you and the weather. And that's where bundling up and dressing appropriately and limiting the time that you're out there really plays an important role in preventing the problem. And too often people underestimate how much they can put up with until it's really sort of too late. And then they come back inside and find out that, fingers or toes are pretty darn blue and numb. If this is still in the reversible stage, simply slowly rewarming the extremities will again bring back normal circulation and cellular function. But it's going to be a fairly uncomfortable process because the nerves that run to those extremities are also going to have been played havoc with by the temperature, both the extremes of being very, very cold and then rewarming. It causes a lot of swelling in the tissues, and this interferes with not only circulation but nervous function as well. So basically, you're going to go from a cold, numb, say fingers or toes, to something that is now pink and warm but very, very uncomfortable. It's going to get a stinging, burning sensation. Now, if you've gone too far and you've actually caused some permanent damage, you may not feel much of anything because the nerve function is lost, and then that area is permanently numb as such. But that's usually a very bad sign that you're going to have permanent damage there. And much like a burn, both cold and burns are thermal injuries. The extremes of temperature are not well tolerated by the cells. But thermal injuries can lead to a sloughing of tissue. It basically dies and just sloughs off. What we refer to as necrosis occurs, and that tissue is permanently damaged, dies, and sloughs off and may not be replaced. Mm-hmm. There are folks who've had things amputated or skin grafted over in an attempt to repair that. Those are all sort of, trying to fix it after the horse is out of the barn, so to speak. So the key really is to try and prevent problems in the first place, and that's being aware of what the temperature is outside, how long you're going to be there, and what kind of clothing or protection are you going to have while you're out there.
Yeah, so I've certainly, we have heard stories or know stories about people who have lost toes or fingers as a result.
Or the tip of your nose.
Or so that really could really could happen. And at this point, if the damage is bad enough, that may still be the kind of thing that would happen. One might have to have something removed.
That has indeed happened.
Okay. Very good. Well, one other thing I thought it might be worth mentioning, and that is at this time of year, because the air is very, very dry, is there a possibility that, particularly if you're doing something to exert yourself, that you could actually become dehydrated?
People frequently associate, you know, the hot, humid weather and sweating and perspiring as times of when they were going to think about dehydration. But in fact, many people in the winter, because it is cold and you don't really think about it, have already cut back on their fluid intake. But in fact, the temperatures are conducive to drier conditions as well, and people need probably just as much fluids in the winter as they do in the summer, and people often have cut back. So if you go out and physically exert yourself, if it's, you know, cross-country skiing or just shoveling your long driveway after a big snow, and exert yourself significantly, you may indeed end up even drier than what you began with, and so dehydration can be a problem even in the winter.
Yeah, and I guess too that we've talked about the fact that if people are having a lot of problems with congestion, with thick mucus and so forth, that one of the simple things that you can do to try to help that is in fact make sure that you get plenty of fluids and don't
oral fluids, as well as increasing some of the fluid that's in the air. The use of a humidifier or vaporizer in the bedroom at night is often very helpful in terms of decreasing some of the congestion that people get nasally. We see a fair number of nosebleeds this time of year simply because the lining of the mucous membranes of the nose have dried out, cracked, bled, and then very easily get bumped and bleed again. The use of nasal saline, a saltwater solution for irrigating the nose and sinuses, is often very, very useful. People can do pretty well just by standing in the shower a couple times a day. A nice hot steamy shower for 15 minutes or so is a good way to inhale a little extra moisture into the mucous membranes of the nose.
Our guest this morning here on Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic, and he is on this program every other month, always on a Monday, to do this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. If you have a healthcare question, give us a call, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems to me when I was a kid that there was a lot, there was sort of more concern about maintaining humidity, particularly if you had small children. Is that something that you still suggest people think about, like in kids' rooms in wintertime at night?
I think that probably stems from the fact that at this time of year, there's a particular type of viral respiratory infection that small children are prone to that in the past was referred to as croup. And what we refer to now as RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, has probably been identified as the culprit for this particular problem. But that barky cough that kids would get in the winter was often made better by increasing the ambient humidity and the old go stand them in the shower to reduce that often did work and is still recommended today. But otherwise, their needs for fluid are similar to adults. And basically, if you're uncomfortable with the situation, they probably are as well.
All right. We have a caller here in Champaign. Let's talk with them on line one. Hello.
Hello. My husband has had a rash for about 3 weeks, and it kind of just comes and goes all over his body. It's not relegated to just one specific area. And I just wondered if you had any suggestions what to use. He's been putting some A and D ointment on the affected areas. He gets these welts and it looks like big red lines go down his legs or his back or even his feet. And there are welts of varying sizes that are on these lines. And this all kind of started when he had been taking sulfa for 2 weeks for an infection, and then he started taking a water pill, which had some, sulfa in it. And once he took the water pill, then he just really got just these gigantic balloon-sized welts, so we stopped that immediately. But it's been a good while since that had happened.
How long has he been off that medication now?
Oh, maybe 4 weeks.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that. It's very bizarre.
Well, as David mentioned earlier, it's oftentimes difficult to do diagnoses over the phone, and when it comes to rashes, it's darn near impossible because it's truly one of those things that you have to see. But in terms of pursuing this a little further, you do mention a couple of things that are probably one of the most common causes for rashes, and that's an allergic reaction to medication.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some cross-reactivity between sulfa drugs and some diuretics.
Uh-huh.
And in most instances, we would have expected, though, that if it was simply due to his medication, that the rash would have gone away within a week after stopping the medication. So the fact that he's continuing to break out several weeks later makes it a little tougher to blame it on the medications.
Mm-hmm.
I would look at any other new things that his system may be coming in contact with, other medications, any changes in things that are physically present on the skin, soaps, laundry detergents, fabric softeners, new clothes, all of those things could potentially produce rashes on the skin. The description welts, or a kind of a fluidy blister-like lesion, is fairly commonly seen with allergic reactions. The fact that it follows lines often indicates that he's scratching at that.
Mm-hmm.
And in sensitive individuals, once you disrupt the skin like that, it will indeed tend to follow down the lines where you've scratched.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are unable to identify any other new contact that might explain an allergic reaction, then it's probably time for him to go visit his doctor, take a look at the rash, determine if there's some other medical illness. There are occasionally times when another type of illness will present with a rash.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly if the rash is persistent, and by persistent we usually mean more than 6 weeks, then it's probably time to start thinking about some of the other medical conditions that could be associated with a rash.
I just wondered, he has been taking Altase for several years for high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And his nurse practitioner changed the Altase dose to a little higher, and it was, I think, made by a different company, but I wouldn't think that would make much difference, but I don't know.
If it's the same medication and the dose is different, usually that doesn't make a difference, especially if he's been on it for a while.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if he was switched from a brand name product to a generic product, while the active chemical within the pill is the same, sometimes the compounds used as filler in the tablet, the things that basically hold the chemicals together so it makes a pill, some of the coloring on the tablets can be chemically different, and there are indeed people who've developed allergic reactions to that if indeed the medication is different.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like what might be the problem, because I wash everything in wool light that concerns him. That's very mild.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Bye.
We have another caller here. They are in Monticello on line number 4. Hello.
Hello. My question is this. Every so often, 3 or 4 times a year, I'll get a headache that seems to last between 3 days to a week with brief periods of remission in there, and nothing I can find over the counter even frightens it. might this be a cluster headache? And if it is there any advantage to naming it? What's my next step?
Have you had any previous evaluation of your headaches?
Mm-mm. Okay. I just kind of said, oh, it's that thing again, and, you know, waited it out.
Right.
I'm thinking maybe there's something more that can be done.
Is there any family history of any type of headache problems?
No, no one in my family has migraines as far as I know.
Okay. And you've been aware of these types of headaches for how long?
Oh, several years.
Okay. Are they associated with menstrual cycles?
No, I don't believe so. But, you know, I hadn't tracked it because they, as I say, they happen 3 to 4 times a year, and mm-hmm. I hadn't really paid attention.
Are you aware of anything else that seems to be associated with them?
No, not really.
When they begin, is there anything that indicates to you that a headache will be starting? Do you get any type of warning?
No, I don't have an aura or anything. The only difference I notice between this and a normal headache is most headaches are either, you know, back of the neck or top of the head.
Mm-hmm.
These are both.
Okay.
They just seem to, I mean, they're both occipital and parietal and everywhere.
And in terms of the character, dull, aching, throbbing, sharp, burning?
I can usually feel my pulse in my head. You know, it's sort mm-hmm. of a throbbing type thing.
Okay. But no change in vision or hearing?
Nope. I tend to be a little bit more sensitive to sound.
Okay. Or light?
No, not light. People just seem to be shouting all the time.
Mm-hmm. And any queasiness associated with it?
Yeah, if it hurts bad enough, I'll feel queasy.
Okay. But no vomiting?
No.
Okay. Certainly, some of the general characteristics of your headache are consistent with migraine.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, if they occur infrequently,
mm-hmm.
And you can take over-the-counter analgesics and they go away, that's perfectly fine mm-hmm. To do so. On the other hand, if over-the-counter medications don't help, there are specific prescription medications for migraine to be used at the time of a headache to try and get that whole process to stop.
Midrin, Imitrex, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those need to be used early mm-hmm. in the course of the headache, because what you've already discovered is that if it doesn't go away soon, it's there for a while.
Yeah.
Right. And on the other hand, there are people whose headaches come so frequently that it becomes reasonable at that point to use medication on a daily basis as a preventive mm-hmm. medication, not something that in and of itself is a pain reliever or pain medication, but something that basically changes the underlying situation so that you're less likely to get headaches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this discussion is all dependent on you having a perfectly normal neurological examination and no other explanation for your headaches.
Mm-hmm.
And there are obviously a fair number of things ranging from high blood pressure to sinus infections and a wide variety of other conditions that could produce head pain. But the mm-hmm. fact that it's intermittent and been present over several years, it sounds like, that
it would either killed me or gone away.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But this is certainly an area where in the last few years specific medications for aborting migraine headaches have become available and are generally very effective. And there are also very good preventive medications if this occurs frequently enough that you'd be willing to take something on a daily basis to try and prevent them.
I don't think I'm there yet, but a visit to my doctor is in order. And
it certainly would be reasonable.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
All right, and thank you. And another caller here, line number 1. This is in Champaign. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
This is somewhat related to the previous call. I've been on low doses of amitriptyline nightly for several years to relieve chronic headache pain. And over time, the dose has been decreased, but not eliminated. My question is this. Recently, I asked my doctor if we could decrease the dosage because I'm groggy in the morning, and it's just a little bit harder to get out of bed and get to work as a result of taking the drug. And so we decreased it down to 10 milligrams an evening before bed, which he wasn't even sure if that would do the job it's supposed to do. In any case, that seems to be working. But what I've done recently is I've begun to take 10 milligrams during the work week and then 20 milligrams over the weekend. And I'm essentially regulating my sleep this way. I sleep a little better on the weekends, but I'm not too groggy during the work week when I have to get up early. And I was wondering if that's an appropriate thing to be doing.
I think that's perfectly reasonable. The doses for amitriptyline can be anywhere from essentially 10 milligrams per day to folks who take a couple hundred milligrams per day, for depending on why you're using it. Amitriptyline is one of those medications where, depending on the dose and the duration of the use, can be used for a variety of different purposes. It's often used to reestablish normal sleep cycles because it does tend to be quite sedating. And that in and of itself often is helpful for a variety of medical conditions where the sleep cycles are disrupted, and that then makes you feel worse the next day when you haven't slept well. Disruption of sleep patterns is one of the most common causes for headaches, and so reestablishing normal sleep cycles is very useful there. At larger doses, amitriptyline has an effect on nerve conduction that tends to decrease our sensation of painful stimuli. It doesn't make it go away or cover it up, but our perception of the stimulus is that it's less painful.
Oh, I see.
And that's it's used in, say, diabetic patients who have painful neuropathies. It's used in patients who've had amputations who then have phantom limb pain. It's used in a variety of situations where you're trying to alter the sensation of a painful stimulus.
Well, and I think that's the reason that I am taking it. When I first moved to Champaign, I had chronic headaches. Every morning I'd wake up with a headache, and it would last all day long. And the doctor did some very extensive investigation, neurological investigation, and in the end decided, well, you're probably just allergic to this area. It happens to a lot of people. He said, we can either find out, we said, we can try to find out what you're allergic to, or we can just use this therapy that will essentially suppress the pain on a regular basis.
Right. And it would also have some benefit in terms of reestablishing a more normal sleep cycle, which allows the next day to then start off better as well. But your use of the smallest effective dose to allow you to function well the next day, I think, is perfectly reasonable. And since your schedule is different on the weekdays than the weekends, I don't see any problem with that at all.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your opinion.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Well, again, our guest here this morning, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic and is on this program with us every other month, always on Monday, for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have questions about your health, or it could also be for somebody in your family, could be children, in fact, because he deals with people of all ages in his practice, you can pick up the telephone and talk with him. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you are, if it would be long-distance call, use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Since this is the cough and cold season and flu season, and people may be heading out to the store to look for some over-the-counter medicines to relieve their symptoms, I want to bring up something, and I've talked about this, I think, probably maybe in some of the other healthcare shows we do, but about 6 weeks ago, the FDA put out a warning about an ingredient that is in many over-the-counter cold medications.
Phenylpropanolamine.
And what the concern apparently is that the FDA thinks that several hundreds of strokes every year are caused by this thing. And they have recommended that people, basically, I think they've recommended that people avoid it. And they've also suggested to the drug manufacturers that they stop using it. And I'm not really sure quite where this stands now. They didn't make an outright ban. They didn't say, you must take all of this off the shelf. What they said was, we think maybe it would be a good idea if you didn't take this and if you drug makers didn't put this in your product. So now, as people are going out there and they're thinking about taking something like this, and hopefully they're actually reading the package and paying attention to sort of what it says. What is your thought on phenylpropanolamine? And would you say that nobody should take it? Would you say maybe there are certain people that you would really suggest, maybe a good idea not to take it?
The fact that there isn't an outright ban on it basically suggests that there is simply some statistical evidence that the drug may have been in certain individuals at least partially causative reason for the subsequent stroke. In the majority of cases, those are going to be more likely to occur in individuals who are at higher risk for stroke to begin with. If there was a large risk in the general public, I would have imagined that that would have been identified a long time ago. That particular substance has been around a long time and commonly used in over-the-counter medications for some time. So I think your average otherwise healthy person who doesn't have any particular risk factors for stroke, and we'll talk about those in just a minute, probably isn't going to be harmed by using a cough or a cold preparation for a couple of days that contains this. And on the other hand, individuals who already have risk factors for stroke, and those basically are age. Basically, as you go up, you're statistically more likely to be at risk for stroke. Any type of vascular disease, if you already have high blood pressure, diabetes, underlying heart disease, smoke, if you have any of those tendencies that are going to put you in a higher risk category for having a stroke, then avoiding anything that might tend to aggravate that would certainly be prudent. In the vast majority of cases, the symptoms that are being treated with the medication in and of themselves aren't fatal. If your nose is a little stuffy, that's maybe uncomfortable, but it's certainly not life-threatening. And there are certainly other ways that that can be handled other than the use of this particular chemical. So I don't think it's certainly going to fall into a category where anybody's going to be seriously disadvantaged if they never take that again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Back here to the telephone and to Watsika, line 4. Hello.
Oh, yes. Doctor?
Good morning.
Good morning. About 3 weeks ago, my daughter brought home a cold, and she got over hers quite well. And I kind of picked it up from her, and I was using this spray that goes in your throat to keep it from, it started in the throat. And since then, it kind of cleared up, and I took 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C right when it started, and now I've wound up with my hearing loss in my right ear. It's absolutely, I don't hear anything in my right ear. And I'm wondering if that has something to do with the cold. I got over the cold real easy, but I'm just wondering what. And I went to the doctor with it, and he looked in the ear and said it was congested, and he told me to use Sudafed, which I did. I used the whole box and some spray that in the nose that he gave me, and it hasn't touched it. It's still.
And how long has it been now?
About 3 weeks, I believe.
3 weeks, that, okay.
It doesn't get any better.
Did you have a hearing test done as well?
No.
Okay. But you think this has significantly impacted your hearing on that side?
Yes, I can't hear anything from that side.
That's not good.
I can't hear what side, where the noise is coming from.
Okay.
Because I can't hear on that one ear, my right side.
What your physician, it sounds like, has treated you for is a relatively common problem that follows fairly routine colds, upper respiratory types infections, where you get a little congestion in what's called the eustachian tube. And this is a drainage mechanism for the middle ear. It basically drains fluid out of the middle ear down into the back of your throat, where your nose and your sinuses all converge.
That's what I thought it was, but he said it was just congestion behind the ear.
Right. And normally that fluid that would be trapped back there should drain out through the eustachian tube. So people are often told to use a nasal spray and a nasal decongestant in order to reduce swelling in the back there where that tube opens up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get that tube to open up, the fluid will often drain out of the ear internally.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll make it feel better. This is often described by folks as a pressure sensation in their ear that is similar to the effect you get when you go up and down on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And your ears need to pop, and it feels odd to you, and you don't hear quite right out of that ear.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that normally would be expected to resolve within a couple of weeks of having had your cold.
Mm-hmm.
If you're still having trouble at this point, you need to have your ear looked at again to see if there's still fluid in there. There are some additional things that can be done if that is the case. Often the use of some nasal steroids and sometimes some oral cortisone-type medication as well will help relieve the congestion.
Uh-huh.
But one other possibility that needs to be tested for here is that there are, as a result of viral infections, people who have permanently lost due to damage to their inner ear,
uh-huh.
their hearing as a result of the infection.
Uh-huh.
And that should be fairly noticeable on a hearing test. So a look in your ear, a measurement of how well your eardrum is functioning in a hearing test, at this point probably need to be done if you're still having trouble.
Uh-huh. I also hear my heart beat all the time, especially at night when I lay down.
Right.
That it just, you know, I hear my heart in my ear. You know?
Right. And that's a fairly common occurrence when it's congested like that.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. And certainly, other folks, if you have questions, you can call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Is there anything new? I'm just thinking about this ear issue. One of the the great sort of curses of having a small child at a certain age is ear problems, ear infections. And there has always been some debate about, okay, well, what do you do about that? Do you put tubes in their ears? Do you use antibiotics? What exactly do you do? Is there anything that's particularly new, or was this controversy still raging just like that?
Well, actually, it is kind of an interesting situation because the whole problem is subject to regional differences in how it's approached. In the United States, the typical approach to the kid's usual middle ear infection is antibiotics. In a number of European areas, they say, it'll go away. And they don't do necessarily anything unless it's a prolonged or really persistent problem. So there are some general differences of opinion. When formal academic studies have been done on the typical red, infected, inflamed eardrum, they basically put a small needle through the eardrum, sucked out some of the fluid back there, and then cultured it to see what grew. And in a number of cases, it's a viral process. And in that particular instance, an antibiotic probably isn't going to make any difference at all.
Hmm.
On the other hand, there are very definitely certain types of bacteria that will also produce an ear infection. And since clinically, when you look at the ear, they look exactly the same, there really isn't any way to tell. The Europeans seem to operate on the philosophy that, well, most of the time it'll be viral, so I'm not going to do anything. The American philosophy seems to be, well, I don't want to miss a bacterial infection, so I'm going to treat it with antibiotics. The current concept behind treating ear infections, I think, probably hasn't changed a whole lot. But it's basically treat the acute infection, if you opt to treat it, and check to make sure that it's resolved. If you only get one or two, that's probably considered pretty much par for the course. If you're getting five or six in a year, you're probably above the statistical average, and then your options become a nighttime dose of antibiotics as a prophylactic agent to help suppress recurrent infection. And sometimes that works, more commonly done in the winter when more upper respiratory infections abound. Or alternatively, you can put a drainage tube in the eardrum. And that's essentially what, when people say they got tubes in their ears, what you have is basically a way of draining infection out of the middle ear by routing it back out through the external ear rather than having it accumulate behind the eardrum in the middle ear space. The major reason for treating ear infections in this regard is you want to try and avoid damage to the little ear bones that help conduct sound. Okay, repeated infection damages those, so a lot of ear infections can lead to hearing loss. In little kids, if they don't hear well, their speech doesn't develop properly. So this is one of the reasons why it's considered more important in small kids to make sure that their ear infections get cleared up. We want them to be able to hear so that their speech will develop normally. The other thing is that an untreated ear infection can then extend internally inside the body into what's called the mastoid cavity, and that's that hard part of the bone directly behind your ear. Now, if you go and talk to your grandparents, and you'll ask them, did you or one of your friends ever have a mastoid operation? You'll find out, oh yeah, everybody had one of those. And it was basically before the days of antibiotics, ear infections would get into the bone behind the ear, and then you'd have to have a surgical procedure to scrape it all out. Mm-hmm. And in the sort of olden days, an infection that extended that far could also go internally further into the brain, and there are kids who had meningitis as a result of their ear infections. Both meningitis as a result of that and mastoid operations anymore are sort of mostly of historical interest now because of the aggressive treatment of ear infections. One of the things that's helped reduce certain types of ear infections is the use of immunizations. Some of the immunizations that kids now receive, in particular Haemophilus, and a newer immunization out for pneumococcal disease should lead to a significant decrease in certain types of ear infections for kids. The real question is whether or not those will simply be replaced by different organisms that will then cause ear infections in kids. The problem in kids is that anatomically, internally, their drainage system is not mature or well-developed, and it doesn't assume a more adult-like configuration until they're about 6 years old in that general ballpark. So ear infections are relatively common in kids, and then they, quote, sort of outgrow it. Mm-hmm. Well, what's happened is that they have physically developed internally to a point where their drainage mechanism is more effective, and they're much less likely to get infections as a result of respiratory infections. The other thing that's occurred is that they've built up some immunity to some of the common respiratory infections as well.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic. This is our Talk to the Family Doctor show. We do this every other month to give you a regular opportunity to ask questions on a wide range of health issues. So if there's something on your mind for you, for your kids, you can give us a call and talk with the doctor. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just on the subject of vaccinations, it looks like we bypassed requiring the chickenpox vaccine, and it's still something that's elective.
Correct.
I wonder what your thought about that is. Is this one of these deals where you would say, as far as you're concerned, you know, parents can say, well, okay, you want it, you don't, it's up to you? Or do you think that it would be a good idea if we said that we were going to add that to the list of routine stuff that we give all kids?
Well, it's routinely available to all kids. It's just that it's not officially required for entrance into school. Recently, I believe the Illinois Department of Public Health viewed all the pros and cons of adding that to the list and basically said there probably isn't enough concern about the level of illness that would be in the school age population to justify a mandatory requirement that everybody be vaccinated. In fact, most chickenpox cases occur in kids who are younger than typical school age. And so kids have usually either had the illness, or if they opted to get vaccinated, they had it done before school anyway. So there's probably a relatively small number of kids in school who either didn't have the illness or who weren't vaccinated. Now, the older you get, probably the more reasonable it becomes to be vaccinated if you haven't had the illness. Chickenpox in an adult is not a pleasant occurrence, and the potential for complications seems to go up with age. Mm-hmm. Most of us think of chickenpox as just that sort of ugly skin problem that, you know, kids get when they get the typical illness, but in fact, chickenpox can be a systemic illness. There is a form of pneumonia that can accompany chickenpox. There's a form of encephalitis that can accompany chickenpox. There are folks, again, typically adults, who have gotten really quite ill as a result of contracting chickenpox as an adult. So even if it's not required for school, I would probably say it's reasonable if a child hasn't had the illness by the time they're getting to be school age, it's not unreasonable at all to think about getting vaccinated. The only real question remaining about the vaccination seems to be how long will it be effective? Mm-hmm. And it seems to be fairly effective. It seems to be very well tolerated. I'm not aware of any real serious problems related to being vaccinated, but it may turn out to be a vaccination not unlike your tetanus, where every 10 years or so it needs to be boosted.
Okay. The number here, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just want to remind you, we got about 5 minutes left here, so if you have a question, there is time if you want to give us a call. Flu shots, I was going to ask about that. If one has not gotten one, can you still get them, and is it now really too late, or is it okay?
It's probably not yet too late. The major concern is that it takes a couple of weeks for the vaccination to basically stimulate your immune system to get an appropriate level of immunity produced. So basically, if you get your flu shot today but get exposed to the flu tomorrow, you'll probably come down with the flu because your vaccine hasn't had a chance yet to do what it's supposed to internally. So the time of year right now is still appropriate for you to get your flu shot because we probably have another 8 weeks at least of potential exposure to the flu season. And since it takes a couple weeks to take effect, you would still get some benefit through the remainder of the winter season from having gotten your flu shot. Now, if it turns out to be late February and you haven't got your flu shot, at that point I'd probably say, well, cross your fingers and take your chances, because in all likelihood the flu season is probably going to be over by the time your vaccine kicks in.
Ask all your close friends and associates if they got their flu shots, mm-hmm. and if they did, then you know, figure maybe you'll be okay.
Just hang around with other vaccinated people.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We have a caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I have two questions to ask. The first one is, every year at about this time, my son always gets really badly chapped lips, and even though he uses medicated Blistex and everything, I was wondering if it was maybe a vitamin deficiency. And the second question is, are there any side effects of getting teenagers on medication to help them with their skin problems?
Well, we'll go after the first one here. In all likelihood, the chapped lips, if it's seasonal, is probably not a vitamin deficiency. There are some oral changes in lips, mucous membrane, tongue that can occur with certain types of vitamin deficiencies, B and C. Those are actually very uncommon and would be unlikely that it would occur on just a seasonal basis. So this is probably just an environmental effect related to the colder, drier air. And as such, physically protecting the lips is about all that I'm aware that you can do there. The second question regarding treatment for acne, acne falls into one of those categories that is rarely fatal. So the decision to treat it is based on how much does this personally bother me. As you're probably aware, teenagers are pretty sensitive about their appearance, so they sometimes consider it to be a big problem. But in most instances, teenagers gradually outgrow the tendency toward acne. Acne is thought to be primarily the result of the excess oil production that the teenage years bring on, in conjunction with bacteria that are on the skin normally that then feed off this oil. So the treatment approaches generally revolve around trying to decrease oil production, and your over-the-counter benzyl peroxide-type compounds help do that. They tend to be somewhat drying. The prescription product, Retin-A, which is a vitamin D derivative, vitamin A derivative, tends to also help decrease oil production, and these are commonly used topically to decrease the amount of oil on the skin, and then some combination of an antibacterial soap with a topical antibiotic is often used to decrease the amount of bacteria that then can feed off the oil. You can also use systemic antibiotics, oral medication. There you're going to start to run into more potential side effects from systemic absorption of the medication. Most of the topical medications don't have a lot of systemic absorption. So in terms of side effects, it's basically just locally, how well does your skin tolerate that? And there's probably not a whole lot of serious side effects related to treating acne with topical medications. One additional option that exists for women is the use of birth control pills. We certainly know that hormonal effects on acne can be pronounced, and in many instances, regulating that hormonal status with the use of birth control pills actually improves a number of women's skin. One additional form of treatment for particularly bad cystic acne is a medication referred to as Accutane. This is a medication that is potentially very powerful, has some very serious potential side effects, needs to be very, very closely monitored by somebody who's familiar with the medication, but in really stubborn cases can be really quite helpful.
And I'm going to have to jump in here with my apologies to the caller, but we've used our time and we're going to have to stop. With the promise, though, that Jeff will be back again in February, right?
January, February, yes.
Okay. To do it again, Jeff Swearingen, he's family practice doctor at Carl Clinic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.